Thank you very much, Mary. My name is Arvidas O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family group. Now can you hear me? There's a character down in Texas that says these things are like old-fashioned spittoons. If you don't get a good aim on them, you make a terrible mess. And that quote was not exactly accurate. I am powerless over people, places, and things. This is something that I have to admit every single day of my life. A life that is unmanageable without the daily practice of the principles of a program that was given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early AA members were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program could work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups, and more recently the Alateen groups, grew to spread all over the world and have shown such astounding results. We subscribe to the principle that alcoholism is a family disease. And I'm afraid that we sometimes get so carried away with telling people how sick we got that we forget to say that we have a program for family recovery. Ours is a fellowship that shares. But we should always remember to share our recovery, not our sickness. And that's why I get so excited about these weekend get-togethers, these conferences and roundups and jamborees that we have all over the North American continent. Because it is in these sessions that we provide for anyone who wants to walk into our meetings a showcase of recovery. If you come into these sessions, you will see whole families getting well together while they're having a marvelous time. And I'm grateful to be a part of this weekend celebration. I don't think it would be very wise for me to stay here very long because you're swallowing me so outrageously. I'm not quite used to having my bed turned down at night and flowers in my room. And I'm afraid if I got used to it, I might miss it when I go back to Texas. But I am most grateful to be here. I regret most deeply that there's an AA meeting going on at the same time because I very much wanted to hear the young lady from California. I have never heard her talk. And I dearly hope that we have some AA people here because it's totally a waste of my time to talk to a group of Al-Anon people because most of them know more about the program than I do. So if there's some AA people here, I'm exceedingly grateful that you're here. I think it's very important for Al-Anon folk to talk at open meetings because it is in open meetings that we can reach the people that we need to reach. And I hope that some of those people are here today. I would like to reach the people here today who are not members of the Al-Anon family group. I'm referring to those people who come to AA conventions. Perhaps you even go to open AA meetings with your AA spouse, but you're not members of Al-Anon, and so you cannot know the joy of seeing a family put back together again because of the Al-Anon family group program. I would like to reach those of you who are here today who live with untreated alcoholism. Those of you who do not know where to go to find the courage that is necessary to live with these very sick people. And I would like to give you the assurance that you can find this courage in an Al-Anon family group meeting. And I would like to talk to those of you who are members of Al-Anon. Those of you who are beginning to find your meetings a little monotonous. Those of you who are sidestepping service assignments when it comes your turn. Those of you who sometimes look at me and say, when I talk about service, oh, I don't care anything about that old stuff, Arbutus. And I want to say to you that if it were not for that old stuff, none of you would be here. Really, what I would like to do here this afternoon is two things. I would like to comfort the disturbed, and I would like to disturb the comfortable. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family group, and this isn't very important, unless you're a long-timer. Long-timers come in two classifications. Some of them are Al-Anon dropouts, and I don't feel very charitable toward these people. And the others are Al-Anon push-outs. And I hope you're not pushing the long-timers out of your home groups. And I'd like to ask you to do me a personal favor when you go back to your home group. Put your long-timers to work. Give them something to do. Ask them occasionally to lead the silent prayer, just as a personal favor to me. Would you do that? It's been my privilege and great joy to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. And I've learned something about people. People are all alike. Every one of you who are here this afternoon are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. We were driven here under the cruel lash of alcoholism because we had nowhere else to go. And I used to think that alcoholism was a product of my generation. But this isn't true. Alcoholism is as old as time. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive disease that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks. But it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I have been able to learn, seemed to be able to do anything about alcoholism before our lifetime, before this generation. Priests and ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. They preached to the alcoholic. They prayed over him. They had him sign pledges. And when these things failed, they damned his soul to hell. The medical people in other generations before our lifetime, the men of science, wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the young medical students before our lifetime, don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless. Preachment failed and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing they knew to do with alcoholics. They must be punished. So, we locked them up in jail. The more they drank, the longer we kept them in jail. And the longer we kept them in jail, the more they drank when they were finally released. It became a vicious circle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment, and society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. We'll never know, I'm sure, how many sick alcoholics have died in the jails across the country at the hands of sadistic jailers. We'll never be able to find out. But there was one group of people who never gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics. the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks. We bailed you out of jail. We pled with judges. We said John's a good man when he's sober. And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And society was puzzled at the behavior of the families of alcoholics. They seemed to be able to understand the alcoholic, but they couldn't understand us. We were the silent majority. They didn't know what to do with us. Our needs went unnoticed and unattended, even when we filled the divorce courts and filled the welfare rolls, and our children showed up in juvenile halls over and over and over again. We tried to solve a problem that had completely and totally baffled the finest minds in the clergy, in the medical field, in the legislature, and we only had one thing going for us. We loved the alcoholic. And we did not know that love was not enough. There were some people, of course, that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people when we continued to love and care for alcoholics. They almost killed us with their pity. We don't need pity, we need understanding. There was others, of course, who thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. And she used to say, God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of Bill and Arbutus. And Mother was right. God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then there was another very significant factor that was a total puzzlement to anyone concerned. Everyone knows, of course, what an alcoholic is. They're sorry, no account, dirty, lazy bums that drink all the time. Everybody knows that. But there were some very brilliant, talented people who developed alcoholism, and this did not fit the pattern. Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He conquered the whole known civilized world when he was only 33 years old, and he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he could not conquer his desire to drink, and he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. He gave the world its most beautiful folk music. And they found Stephen Foster sick to death on the New York Bowery, and when he was dead, they found in his pockets 38 cents, one penny for each year of a misspent life and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair. But the love of his wife could not stop him from drinking, and he died drunk. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in the Bible. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of the alcoholic in the story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my own living room. Many of you saw it too. You saw the bottle change the man you love, or it could have been your wife, into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, history books say very little about the families of these men and others like them. But I believe that I know the fear and the loneliness that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. And I believe that I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe that I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I believe that I know the serenity that they both knew when he found sobriety. My friends and Al-Anon sometimes say to me, why do you feel it's necessary, arduous, to give us a history lesson every time you walk up to one of those podiums? I can't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline. No, I tell you these things to point out to you that it is no longer necessary for a man to die in drunken ignorance as did Stephen Foster. Nor is it necessary to go to a South Sea island to find sobriety, because it's as close to you as the nearest meeting place. And these very same people who were so totally helpless to do anything about the disease of alcoholism before our lifetime are doing a great deal about it right now. Christian ministers now believe that alcoholics are God's children too. And they send them to treatment centers, and they send their families to us so they can get well too. County judges send alcoholics for treatment instead of sending them to jail. You can get an alcoholic in the hospital now with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. It isn't necessary any longer for a doctor to jeopardize his medical license and falsify the diagnosis. You can get them in the hospital with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. This wasn't possible only a few years ago. Magazines and newspapers write articles about alcoholism. It's almost impossible to pick up a magazine anymore and not find an article about alcoholism. It's beginning to be the end thing to have an alcoholic in your family. If you don't have one in your family, go out and borrow one. If you come down to my house, I'll give you two or three. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I would not downgrade our friends in the profession. I have tremendous respect for their training and for their good intentions. But with all the efforts that are being made in all the areas of treatment and information on alcoholism, these dear people are not getting the job done. They're simply not getting the job done. Because, you see, they don't know all there is to know about alcoholism. But this afternoon, when I look out over this room full of people, I know that I'm looking at a room full of experts. You're the people who know about alcoholism. You know about alcoholism because you have lived with it. You know the symptoms of alcoholism. You know the progression. You know about the alibi system. You know about slips in AA. You know about alcoholic convulsions. Some of you, bless your heart, have lived through the terrors of DTs. There isn't very much about alcoholism that you do not know because you've lived with it. So in my opinion, this is a job for you to do. A job for you and for me. And I learned this a long time ago. You see, I came into this outfit of ours before we had an outfit. I really did. When I came here, we didn't have a program to live by, nor a purpose to live for. We didn't have 8 hardback books and umpteen pieces of literature. We didn't have any literature at all. All we really had in those very early days was the growing awareness of a great need and the dubious permission of some people who were very new in Alcoholics Anonymous to come to their meeting places while they had a meeting. And so we met in little corners and alcoves and dirty little kitchens around the country, and we talked. Now, I'm not going to have to tell you what we talked about. It was kind of a morbid competition to determine which one of us was living with the sorriest man. Those meetings were not very constructive. But may I remind you, young people, you newcomers in Al-Anon, that if we had not been there then, you would not be here now. So don't be too critical of those early groups. I sometimes say that Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention because they were both born of necessity. And the dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous together knew that in time we would become aware of this necessity, and so when they wrote the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they made provisions for us because they included in that book two chapters for the families of alcoholics. Now, one of those chapters is entitled To the Wives, and your very early groups in Canada were called Wives Groups. Some of you probably remember that. And the other chapter is, but let me catch up myself here a moment. The title of this chapter is not intended to be a put-down to the fine men who are members of the Al-Anon family group. The simple fact of the matter is that when that book was written, there were no women in AA. So they simply wrote that chapter to the wife. The other chapter is entitled To the Family Afterwards. And this is how we started. This was all the information or all the literature that we had to begin with. And down in my part of the country, we took a paragraph from the chapter To the Family Afterwards, and we made of it a little preamble that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. And we feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, every member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. I am no longer accurate on my accounting for the number of pieces of literature that we have. I think it's in the neighborhood of 100 pieces. But as far as I'm concerned, there's not one single piece of literature that we have that more clearly points out to me what my responsibility is to the families of alcoholics. Nor do we have one single piece of literature that more clearly points out to me what I can do to show my gratitude for the sobriety in my home and for the good things that sobriety has brought to us. And now I'm going to get into trouble. There are those who say that Al-Anon folks should not read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. They even go so far as to say that it is not conference approved. It is conference approved. It's approved by the AA conference, which predates the Al-Anon World Service Conference by 13 years. And if you... And if you should be unfortunate enough to have me for a sponsor, my first requirement would be for you to study the first 164 pages of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in order that you might know what the philosophy of this fellowship is all about and how you can go about changing your life. Now, you did hear me. If I am your sponsor, I make this requirement. Now, what the rest of you do with the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is entirely on your conscience. I have only one criteria for this opinion. The people I sponsor seem to get well. And if you would like to know the philosophy of the fellowship that is going to govern your life for as long as you may live, I strongly suggest that you investigate the possibility of reading this book any time that you have an afternoon off. And if you ever come down to West Texas, please notify us so we can hide our big books in the Al-Anon Family Group libraries, would you please? Because we use them down there. In Al-Anon, we simply say, I share with you my experience, strength, and hope, and love. And that's what I came up here to do. I attended my first AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948. And I did not want to go to that meeting. My Bill had learned about Alcoholics Anonymous in Fort Worth, Texas in 1945, but my Bill did not get sober until 1951, and I could see no constructive purpose to be served in associating myself with a group of people who, by their own admission, had ruined everything they'd ever tried to do. They'd ruined their own lives. They'd ruined their health. They'd lost their wives and families. They'd lost their businesses. Some of them had been in jail. And I didn't want to associate with this kind of people. I was having quite enough trouble with one alcoholic. I certainly didn't want to get mixed up with a group of them. But I went to the meeting. The only reason I went to that meeting is because I had put myself under obligation to a very lovely woman who was married to an AA member. And if you have not discovered it by now, I will tell you that I am a hillbilly. And hillbillies don't like to be obliged to folks. So I went to the meeting for that reason only. I drink a lot of coffee, and I'm quite sure I made many trips to the coffee bar. And it was an open meeting, such as we're having here this afternoon. There was about 100 people there. And after the meeting started, a very lovely woman that I later learned was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across Marguerite, who had taken me to the meeting, and she whispered to me. And what she said was, how long has it been since you had a drink, honey? And I wasn't embarrassed by her question. I'm not a teetotaler. I used to say I didn't trust teetotalers, but I don't say that anymore. I have a friend in Al-Anon who's never had a drink in her life, and that makes her a teetotaler. And I would trust her with my life, so I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was terribly embarrassed. She was just wiped out. She was embarrassed to death. And so she answered the question for me. She said, Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My dad was a two-fisted construction man who worked hard and drank hard and played hard. He was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry. He taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, Dad turned into a devil. My dad was a craftsman, the likes of which they don't make anymore. And he loved to build things for my mother. Dad loved wood. I've watched Dad caress a piece of wood, much the same as a lady caresses a piece of velvet, perhaps, or a piece of satin. And he would say of the wood as he caressed it, it has a beautiful thought. And I didn't know what Dad was talking about until I found this program. He would select the wood for the things that he built for my mother very carefully. He would fit them together with great precision as only a craftsman can do. He would work on these objects literally for months. He would sand them and polish them and make of them truly a thing of beauty. And then he would smash them in a drunken fury. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my lovely, beautiful mother into an old, ugly woman who hated him. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and buried. And the last years of my mother's life that she spent in total darkness, she hated anyone who had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. Dad was one of those people who never found this program. He couldn't find the want to. He used to come to Texas, and he'd go to AA meetings with Bill and me, and we'd come home from the meetings, and he'd say to us, "How do you get the want to? How do you get the want to?" Dad couldn't find the want to, and he couldn't stay sober. And for many years after I found the courage in this program to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I used to close every single day of my life with one special prayer. God, don't let my dad die drunk. And I cannot tell you why this is such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I can only tell you that it is. My father died in 1965. He died of throat cancer. He didn't die drunk. And when my oldest brother, Mike, called me in Texas to tell me that they had diagnosed Dad as having cancer, he said to me, "We're going to have to pray awfully hard, Arbia. Dad isn't going to make it." And I said, "No. No." God answers my prayers. You know I didn't want my dad to have cancer. You know I didn't want that filthy stuff to tear out his throat. You know I didn't want it to eat up that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't. I prayed, "God, don't let my dad die drunk." And I wish I could tell you these things in a nice, quiet way. I just can't. I do not tell you these things about my mother and my dad. Believe me that you may weep for them. I tell you these things about my mother and about my dad, that you may know I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore the family. My dad's all right, and so is mother. You see, Dad doesn't have to drink anymore, and mother doesn't hate him. I learned a lot about alcoholics. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that of all the things an alcoholic loves, he loves his family most. Even when they tear us down over and over and over again, they love their families most. Of this I am convinced. And because I know these things, I want to restore their families. And I would also like you to know that I was not one slightest bit concerned with my Bill's drinking when we were married. Not one bit. Father Joe Martin says the only criteria that you have to judge alcoholism is by the alcoholic that you know. And Bill's drinking was not like Dad's, and I was not one bit concerned. I drank with Bill, and we had a lot of fun. We worked for an advertising firm that sent us all over the United States, and all the people that worked with us, all of us were about the same age. And we had a marvelous time. It was exceedingly important in my generation to have fun. And Bill and I had so much fun, it almost killed us. We got drunk everywhere we went. We never were in Toronto, Ontario, or I'm quite sure we would have been drunk here. We got drunk everywhere we went. And no one was concerned about it. Least of all, I was concerned. But in 1942, things happened that should have made Bill and me grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war. And I quit drinking with Bill. It was that simple. Things were too serious. My brothers were in service, and members of his family were in service, and we were reading casualty lists and this kind of things, and I simply quit drinking with Bill. We had our second child the next year, and Bill was not there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, and she met her father on Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that you men bring to us when we have your babies, he caused a great deal of commotion in the Catholic hospital where Nancy was born. He wanted to teach the Catholic sister who was in charge of the maternity ward to Texas stomp, and the good sister didn't want to dance. And he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window and forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. The next year we had our little boy. I heard a non speaker down in Tennessee tell her story, and her husband was a game warden, and they had a lot of guns around the house, and she tried to keep her husband sober with a shotgun. And it dawned on me that I tried to keep my husband sober by having babies. But when Luther came, it was not the same story at all. Something went wrong in the delivery room, and they needed Bill. And they couldn't find him. He just simply walked out of the waiting room and disappeared. And of course, I wasn't able to answer any questions for them, or I could have told them where to find him. I could have told them that they found him in a bar. But you see, I didn't know which bar. Now, my friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. And I believe that they believe this. But I believe that I know something about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife when she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. This, I believe, is loneliness. The loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child who cries for her dad. And you can't find her dad. I want my daddy. And you don't know where he is. This, I believe, is loneliness. And the lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. Our young son was born with a birth defect. And it took me a long time in Al-Anon before I was able or willing to admit to the guilt that I felt over this child's birth. I manipulated that pregnancy because I knew Bill wanted a son. I guess every man does. And I gave Bill a son who couldn't walk. And I watched Bill stand by that child's crib, this golden-haired little boy of ours who couldn't kick and go get drunk. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. We had another little girl in 1943, and Teresa was one of those beautifully healthy youngsters who thrived on love and neglect, which was very fortunate because that's all she got. And I began this trek of finding a doctor that would make our son walk. The crippled children's hospitals and the examinations and the x-rays and all the things. Because I was determined that that boy would walk. I was determined that boy would walk. And I had nothing going for me except medical science. And I was positive sure that somewhere in the broad expanse of the United States of America that there was some clinic or some specialist who could do the things for my son that I was unable to do for him. I had no God, and so I had no one other than medical science to depend on. And when Teresa was born, the disease of alcoholism had progressed into such a point that Bill was having personality clashes with the people that he worked for, and he changed jobs pretty often. I can recall that one of those jobs took us down to Knoxville, Tennessee, about the time that they brought that atomic energy plant into that part of the country. And Bill had a good job. He worked for Holland Furnace Company. He was sales manager for the company, and it was not at all unusual for Bill to make $600 or $700 a week in legitimate expense, legitimate commission, and then he was not reluctant to take a little payola money under the counter if you need the furnace very badly. And so it was not lack of funds, but we were evicted from a house that rented for $50 a month for non-payment of rent. And then I was to begin the experience of receiving more and more eviction notices. And each time that one of those notices was served on me, I would see the look of pity and disgust in the faces of those who served them. And then again, I was to know another experience, the experience of going to a welfare agency to get food for your children and treatment for your young son. And I'm not sure to this very day that my friends in Texas quite appreciate this part of my story, because I don't think there's anything on God's earth that is more humiliating or degrading to such as me, such to people such as me. I don't know if you can understand what it means for a hillbilly to accept charity. And don't you sit back there and think while I'm saying these words, I wouldn't do that, because you will. You will. You'll go get charities to feed your babies. Don't you think you won't? And again, I was to see the look of pity and disgust on the social worker's face when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I would like you to know that when I came to the state of Texas in 1944, I had never heard this term in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever heard this term in reference to Bill's drinking. And I watched that boy lose everything he had that he wanted to keep. And he couldn't stop drinking. My Bill lost his left eye in a drunken accident, and he couldn't quit drinking. My Bill lost his left arm as a direct result of drinking, and he couldn't quit drinking. He lost the respect of his friends and the affection of his family. He lost his own self-respect, and he could not stop drinking. And I watched this happen to him, and I wanted to help him. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to help Bill. And I could not. And I would never want to say anything from one of these podiums that would make any alcoholic in the world feel badly or uncomfortable. Please understand that. But I want to say something directly to those of you who are alcoholic. I've heard members of AA stand behind podiums like this all around this country and have the asinine gall to say a non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I wanted to help them. We're not stupid, calloused people. I'll tell you what you do to us. It seems to me that you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we can see you, and we can hear you. We know the mental torture that you endure. We know the physical torment. But we can't get through to you because you won't let us. It's the same feeling that you have when you tend a sick child. The baby's sick, its little body's burning up a fever, and it cries, and you want to help the baby and make it well. But you can't, because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we couldn't help them, but we wanted to. I venture to say that there's some alcoholics within the sound of my voice that would not be alive today if it were not for someone like me. And please remember the next time that you indict non-alcoholic people, will you please remember that we wanted to help you. We wanted to help you. And it was because of this unholy compulsion that totally and utterly demoralized both Bill and me that we started on what I like to refer to as a new kind of education. And it was in the pursuit of this education that we learned many things and we met many people. Now, the first of the people, of course, that we met were the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never shall forget the first AA member that I ever talked to. He came to my house one afternoon, and he talked to me about this rehabilitation program, was the term that I used for it, this rehabilitation program that he had for alcoholics. And after about 2.5 hours, I asked him a question. I said, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics?" And he couldn't answer my question. I don't think anyone had ever asked him that before. He said, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem. You do not have a problem." I thought the gentleman was wrong. I still think he was wrong. I can remember that cold, bleak November afternoon just as well as if it were today, when I stood in the living room of a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we now live. And I couldn't wear sleeves on my arms because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I was so nervous that I literally could not stand in my own shoes, and that good AA member said to me, "You do not have a problem." And I believe it was that soft, same, cold, bleak November afternoon that I made up my mind that someday, somehow, I would find a way to help the families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came to me because then I met another group of people. Now, this was a strange, weird group of people. They were non-alcoholics. They found it vitally necessary to practice the principles of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous to preserve their stability and to restore their sanity. These people entertain the same fears as does the alcoholic. These people nourish the same self-pity and develop the same resentment as does the alcoholic. There was only one difference.
These people did not have the allergy to booze, and this was the most revolting development of all, because this meant that they had to take their punishment standing up cold sober. And there's not an alcoholic in the world that can do it, not without help. And you know something? We couldn't either. We only thought we could. We used to be smug enough to stand in meetings and say one to the other, well, after all, we do not suffer the physical manifestations of this illness. Well, now, don't we? I'm not quite ready to entertain the thoughts of being called a senior citizen, but some of our members are approaching middle age, you might have noticed. And we're discovering that some of them are developing ulcerated stomachs so serious that they have to have surgery. Some of our folk are going to hospitals with serious heart conditions. Some of our folk are being locked up in mental wards where they'll never come out again. Would you not begin to suspect that we might be manifesting the physical and mental, exhibiting the physical and mental manifestations of the illness? I think perhaps we are. But we were smug enough to think that we weren't. Excuse me. Some of the people in this new group that I found seem to have been born with an understanding heart, and the rest of them seem to have developed this understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy, and I knew these people. Right off, I knew these people. These people could give me courage to face life one day at a time. And I used to say they didn't have a name, but that isn't quite true. They had a lot of names. As I said a moment ago, the groups up in this part of the country were called the Wives Groups. Down in our part of the country, they were called non-AAs. They were called AA Auxiliaries. They were called AAA Family Groups. They were called any number of things, some of which I cannot repeat in polite society. Eventually, of course, they came to be known as the Al-Anon Family Groups. And you may suspect that I am a little prejudiced about these people. Quite frankly, I think they stand head and shoulders above anybody in the world, including AA folk. And again, please don't misunderstand me. I have a tremendous affection for AA people. God knows I should. They saved the lives of half my family, as I shall tell you in a moment. But there were six people in that family, and we were all sick. And we took the principles of the Al-Anon Family Group to enable me to rear those four children. And I went around your country and mine for a great number of years, challenging any one of you to stand up for people that could match the O'Neill crew. I really did. Some of you heard me. I took the principles of this program, and we had a good family. That little guy of mine that couldn't walk when he was 3 years old, weighed into the Navy when he was not quite 18 years old at 189 pounds. Physical therapists tell us that there's one out of each 1,000 people who have perfect coordination, and that includes Luther O'Neill. And I quite freely admit to you that when he runs across a parking lot at Jump the Fence, I get a lump in my throat because this wasn't supposed to happen. These kids grew up, and I put everything I had into giving them things that I thought we had denied them, such things as good schools and good educations, and they've got more degrees than the thermometer. And everything went along fine. And then they got mixed up with some other people's kids. To date, we have 3 AA members in the O'Neill family and 3 non-alcoholics. But the principles of this program have allowed me to release these people, to handle their illness and make their own choices. Luther has been in AA for 3 years. His sobriety date is February 14th this year. That means he had a slip. And I didn't bat an eye. I know about slips. Our Nancy, this beautiful young lady of ours, who was a top flight airline stewardess for American Airlines, who came out of Airline Stewardess College with the highest grade they've ever recorded, who was physically perfect and psychologically sound, has been in the AA recovery program since September 4, 1981. I know the percentages. And I believe it's harder for second generation AAs than it has been for the first crop, because they knew all the answers. And it was hard. It was hard to let my children do the things that they had to do and find recovery. It hasn't been easy. The last time that I saw Fern in Dallas, Texas, if somebody had handed us a razor, we'd both cut our throats. And we're good, sound, card-carrying Al-Anon members. But sometimes all you can do is just hang on, just barely. And that's all you can do. In 1979, I went to an Al-Anon meeting at noon. Picked up 50 strawberry plants as I came home from the meeting and put them out in my backyard. And the sky looked funny. It didn't bother me too much. I have a very serious visual problem, and I'm a lazy looker. But the populace was a little nervous. And my Bill turned on the television set to listen to the newscast. And we heard that a tornado hit Vernon, Texas, 52 miles west of us. 30 minutes later, one hit Lawton, Oklahoma, 35 miles north of us. And the man on the newscaster said there was a tornado cloud boiling over the skies of Wichita Falls. He suggested that we get to the center of our house and open the doors on the north and the windows and doors on the north and on the west sides of our houses. And those three boogers got together in what developed to be one of the strongest tornadoes they've ever had in the state of Texas or probably anywhere else. When they put on a show for me, they do it up brown. Took out 2,500 houses and stayed on the ground for 45 miles. I was watching the television set and a young man lost his professional cool and screamed into the microphone, "For God's sake, take cover." And Bill O'Neill tackled me and put me on the floor. It took him 40 years to put my face in the dirt. But I'd like you to know that it's not too difficult to start over when you're 25 years old or 50 years old. It's kind of tough when you're 63. When you watch everything that you've accumulated in a 40-year marriage, it disappears in 6 minutes. It's kind of tough. My Bill started taping AA conventions back in 1959 because he liked to listen to these things. Other folks seem to, so he makes copies for them. He had over 4,000 reels of Al-Anon and AA talks in a tape library in our home, which was 4.5 feet lower than the rest of the building, just about like stepping down off of this platform. When the wind quit blowing, it took us about an hour to dig out from under the rubble. Bill O'Neill got out and looked at me and said, "Don't see anything wrong here, Ma. Ain't you glad the wind quit blowing?" I wish to God that he'd eaten that big AA book about that time. And I dreaded so much to walk the 10 or 12 feet across the kitchen, what used to be the kitchen, into the tape room. Because I knew those tapes would be strung all over Oklahoma. The roof was gone. The walls were gone. But not one single reel of those tapes had fallen out of the cases. So, we went to an AA convention a couple of days later. We didn't have any house to stay in. And Bill called his auntie down in Brownwood, Texas, and she knew we were alive, and she said, "Billy, what did you lose?" And he said, "Not anything that can't be replaced, Aunt May." She said, "Come on home, son, until you decide what you want to do." So we went down to Brownwood, Texas, and discovered a little lady that was in process of closing her home to go in a nursing home. And Bill didn't like that idea. So we kind of serve a mutual need for each other. We need a home to live in, and she needs someone to live with her. She's 97 years old. She's blind and in a wheelchair. And when I left to come up here Thursday morning, she was putting her laundry in the washing machine. Bill's sister's staying with them this weekend, and she said, "What must I do to help Aunt May?" And I said, "Stay out of her way." She's quite sure that I'm frozen into an icicle. And when I arrived here Thursday afternoon and saw those snowbanks, I was beginning to wonder if perhaps she wouldn't be right. But I've learned that this program works for people who are not alcoholic just as well as it works for people who are alcoholic. Some mornings, Aunt May gets up and they're just not any way she's going to be happy. They're just not any way. And so I say to her, "Aunt May, I'm so sorry that you don't feel good. And if there's anything I can do to make you happy, will you please tell me? But right now, I'm going over and help Bill." And I cut up. And it worked so fine with Aunt May, I pulled it on Bill. When he slammed that car door, I know something went wrong down at the post office. And so I look at Bill and I say, "Honey, I am so sorry you're unhappy. If I can do anything about it, you be sure and tell me. But right now, I'm going over and help Aunt May." And the Al-Anon family group there was scared to death when I came to town. They knew I was going to roll up both sleeves and walk in there and take over that group. My God, I don't need a group. I need a meeting once in a while. Well, no, not once in a while, all the time. But they're beginning to trust me. They occasionally let me lead the silent prayer. And things are all right. I want you to know that things are all right in my life. I don't have a pot in the window, and I don't want one. I will never again be owned by things. At Christmas time, I got a little wistful. I wanted so very much to have open house, but I don't have a house. I couldn't shine any crystal. I don't have any crystal. No silverware. I got 6 bath towels, and that's all you need. That's all you need. I don't have any stacks of things anymore. It's the most freeing experience I've ever known in my life. And Bill was so nice to me. He said, "You can come and help me in the library." And that's what I do. I play around with those tapes, and I hear people from Australia and New Zealand and Finland and Japan, Canada occasionally, talk on tapes. We send tapes to prisons and hospitals and to people overseas if they'll just ask us for them. We make the rest of you pay for them so we can do that. And it's not all bad. It's not all bad. I talked to a very new Al-Anon group up in Dallas very recently. And I said to them, "The principles of this program will help you solve any living problem." And a very young lady said to me, "Yes, I believe you believe that." No, I don't believe that. I know that. We think some things and we believe some more things and we only know a few things. And I know that the principles of this program will solve any living problem that you will ever have. You can take my guarantee on that. But I will close with one thing that I must never forget to tell you. The principles of this program carry a message that the whole world needs to know. And we're the only people in the world that are quite so uniquely qualified to carry that message. I've thoroughly enjoyed this weekend. This is a tremendous place you've got up here. My God, this building's worth coming all the way to Texas to see. That is, if you could ever find your way around in it, it would be. But this is a tremendous place. But I venture to say that with a stone's throw of this magnificent hotel, there are men and women who will die in drunken ignorance, never knowing anything about alcoholism, if we fail to carry this message. And you know as well as I do that right here in Toronto, Ontario, and down in Dallas, Texas, or Brownwood, Texas, or anywhere else that you want to go, you know that there's men and women who will not have the courage to live one more day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their homes if we fail to carry this message. And today's Saturday. Do you notice that? Saturday nights are the worst of all, remember? And there's kids in this town and in my town and every other town that you and I, either one, know anything about. And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if we fail to carry this message. And if we fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us.